This is A Confused Heap of Facts, the podcast where we have a discussion about history with the faculty of the Department of Military History and the U.S. Army Command and General Staff College. The views expressed in this podcast are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect the official policy or position of the Department of the Army, Department of Defense, or U.S. government. Dr. Jonathan Abel. I'm here with Dr. Bill Nance.
Hello.
And today we're talking with Dr. Mark Gerges, who is one of our many Napoleonists in the department. Dr. Gerges, welcome.
Good morning.
So one of your many areas of specialty is on the Peninsular War, and a very specific aspect of the Peninsular War that we'll get into when we talk about cavalry there. But before we do that, I kind of want to start, you know, very big picture. When we say the Peninsular War, what do we mean?
We're talking from August 1808 until April of 1814. Mm-hmm. And we are talking the fighting that went over Portugal, Spain, and into southern France during that time period. Everything from Napoleon's invasion, the first one in November of 1808, up through the big invasion, mm-hmm. and then the fighting against it. Again, up through the invasion of France in 1814.
Okay, so what makes the Peninsular War different from other Napoleonic wars, where you might have a more typical conventional army fight, then Napoleon finds the enemy leader and they agree to a treaty after the battle?
Mm-hmm. Well, and fascinating, because that typical search for a decisive battle that would then end the war, where it appears there is that initial decisive battle, and I think Napoleon would be the first one to think there was going to be one, it doesn't end. Mm-hmm. You know, he races to the capital, defeats the Spanish armies, races to the capital, and then the country just falls into chaos, and you get a bunch of juntas that are going to rise up and fight the French. Well, at the same time, there is a centralized junta government that is establishing regular field armies, and so you've got this mixture of guerrilla bands, regular armies, and then you've got Wellington's, what will become Wellington's forces, British Anglo-Portuguese army coming in from Portugal.
So mm-hmm. What's the physical terrain look like in the peninsula? Because that's almost a character in itself, right? Mm-hmm. So could you kind of walk us through what the kind of the battle area looks like?
Well, you've got Portugal, which is separated by a series of mountains from Spain proper, with really just two big invasion routes, one up about down by Badajoz, the other one up around Ciudad Rodrigo, which are the major invasion routes. And then you've got that central plain in the north around Salamanca, a line of mountains running down the kind of the center spine of the country, and then the north up the Galicia coast, and there is very mountainous, and then also down to towards the south. So mm-hmm. You've got a very great variety of terrains in there, and then also mountainous areas that make great refuge for guerrillas.
Okay, what about infrastructure out there? Like, if I'm gonna be moving around armies, is there a lot of space to do that? Or
I'm trying to remember the exact quote about Spain's the country where big armies starve. Small armies are consumed, and big armies starve, because there is the infrastructure, but the distances, and just the movement is so large. A relatively good road structure in there, but you know, Spain is, and Portugal have fallen off from their great centuries of a century or two before. So there are a lot of infrastructure needs, but for the most part, that is really not hindering operations.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think it's worth pointing out, Iberia collectively is about the size of Texas. And it's largely relatively resource poor, particularly the center of Spain.
It's like West Texas. You don't grow much there. You can't really feed armies there. So it's big, and you have operating room, but the population tends to be focused in the major cities of the regions.
And a lot of the areas, too, have gone to an export economy where they're not growing... they're not growing crops to feed the people. They're growing crops that they can export and make more money and then import the foodstuffs they need. So, you know, Barcelona and the Catalan coast is going to be doing a lot more grape, or not grapes, but olives and olive oil for exporting to get the money. So once the actual normal trade falls apart, those regions aren't feeding themselves initially.
Yeah, so let's touch a little bit on the human geography, because I think this is one of the more interesting aspects of the conflict. By and large, the people of Spain and Portugal are very Catholic and very traditionalist. Mm-hmm. So how is that a problem for the invading French?
Well, they're seen as the, you know, as atheist and the Antichrist and everything else. So you have this huge movement supporting the Catholic Church, which is also kind of an interesting aspect with the British coming in as a bunch of Protestants. And so there is a tension there, even between the Allies, religious tension that is going to go on. But for the, particularly when you start getting out into the countryside, the clergy is closer, they're very, very relatively poor. The church in the rural areas are poor. So the priests tend to be, you know, Jose from the down the block. They work the farms. They do those type of things. And so as the guerrilla movement grows up, they become leaders in that guerrilla movement, which is entirely separated from the big cathedrals in the major cities, which are seen more as kind of a parasite, if you will, on the people of the city. So you get these two different views of the Catholic Church.
Yeah, it almost sounds like you're talking about almost a proto-Marxist class struggle within Spain between the rich bishops and the poor parish priests. So when the French come in, when Napoleon comes in 1808, he chases off the British, in fact kills their commander. He now has occupied Spain and to parts of Portugal in the same way that he has occupied, say, Germany in prior years. What does he expect to happen after John Moore dies?
I would correct one thing there. I mean, Moore's campaign is a minor footnote compared to the fighting against the Spanish armies that are up along the Ebro River. He attacks, disperses the armies there. He is racing down that central corridor, heading towards Madrid, finds out the British are there, is going to turn, and that's where Ney is going to race up to Coruña, and they'll have the battle as they're trying to embark on things. But that's really a kind of footnote. He has destroyed the main Spanish armies, and he expects to go into Madrid, establish his brother. Well, his brother's already been on the throne, and reestablish him and have a friendly allied state down his southern border. But there's already been some of the some of the first hints, if you will, of the depth, the problem he's going to have in Saragossa that summer, where the initial siege that's going to take place. There's only a handful, I think 1,000 Spanish soldiers. Most of the defenders are just Spanish people from the town who are going to hold out against it. So you start to see that sort of popular movement against the French movement. And part of that goes into the complexity of what goes on. We talk this idea of hybrid warfare, and it's much more complex than, I guess, the popular image of it is, because Spain always has armies, and the biggest thing the army is, they're like that that blow up. We used to have those the punching bag things that you'd punch it, it'd fall over, and then would pump back up. That's what the Spanish armies are. They keep taking a lick, and they keep on ticking. They keep coming back again and again and again. And it's the dynamic of the French armies have to come together to fight a conventional Spanish army, beat them 99-4400 of the time. They scatter. But the French army, to do that, has had to come together in large mass armies to be able to fight, which cedes the ground to guerrilla forces. And so a lot of times when they have guerrillas almost on the edge, and they've been chasing this bands, they have to then stop the pursuit, pull together to face another Spanish army. And then once you get into the middle part of the war, by 1812, you actually have the Spanish army doing, I don't want to use counter guerrilla because that seems more kinetic, but they're trying to get rid of guerrilla bands because they can get lots of volunteers for guerrilla bands in their local towns. However, there's not a Frenchman within 100 miles, so they don't need a guerrilla band there. They need soldiers for the regular army, and so they're having to go after the guerrillas to get them to bring recruits into the regular army.
Mm-hmm. But it's so much more fun hanging out in the mountains.
Yes.
And those guerrilla bands might just fight the Spanish army on occasion, especially after the war. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a good point. So let's put the other hat on now. We've talked kind of about the problems the French have. What are the British doing there? Why do they care?
Well, the British and the Portuguese have had a commercial treaty back to, I think it's 1379 or
something. Yeah, it's the oldest treaty.
And there's a lot of British interest, particularly with wine production and port and that stuff. So it's one of the great... they have a lot of people who speak Portuguese because of the great families that are in the wine production. But it's basically, they have been kicked out of the continent. They have been looking for some way of getting back in the summer of 1808 when they're sending out convoys. They're literally going out. I think there's four convoys, and it's not really sure where they're going to land. They're looking for a place. And then that's where they're going to land in Portugal and have the first battles there, Lethe and Guillermo, which is going to start making, at that time, Arthur Wellesley's name. He's going to go up. But Britain is looking for a way of trying to get back into the continent. And because of Portugal, because of the mountain ranges that allows them to defend with lesser number of troops because of the interaction with the Portuguese. The Portuguese royal family is going to leave and go to Brazil and not come back after the war. So they are allowing British officers to be seconded to the Portuguese army. And that allows Britain to have a relatively small footprint, but then also integrate in a Portuguese. And when you talk about Wellesley's and Wellington's army, it really truly is an Anglo-Portuguese army. Mm-hmm. And that's part of the fight they're going to have with their allies. But it takes advantage of the Royal Navy and the sea power to be able to supply it. So it's probably the best location that they can go.
You said a couple things that I want to drill down on. One, for listeners who aren't familiar, Wellington is Arthur Wellesley, who becomes the I think it's the Earl and then the Duke of Wellington later, so that's why you get the two names. So first, the land component. Is it fair to characterize the major muscle movements of the war as Wellington and Portugal trying to get into Spain, the French uniting against him, pushing him back, then dispersing to do counter-guerrilla operations, and you have this kind of seesaw?
Yes and no, because the French are dispersing to fight the Spanish armies as much as anything else. Part of it is through 1810 and Massena's invasion, Marshal André Massena's... André Massena's almost got Victor in there. André Massena's invasion. Wellington is stuck. He comes in the summer of 1809 in what's going to become the Talavera campaign, thinking that he could be fed, thinking he can get horses, thinking that the Spanish army is going to provide all this logistic support. Gets up to Talavera and realizes that they can't feed their own troops. They certainly aren't going to feed theirs. They're going to fight a battle. He holds the field, but then, because of logistics, he's going to have to retreat back. And he's so sick and just disgusted by the support he gets that at that point, from July of 1809, he stays in Portugal and would have stayed in Portugal until the effects of really the Russian campaign in 1812 is going to start changing that dynamic. But for the most part, he's stuck in Portugal. He doesn't have the strength to enter into Spain for any kind of lasting time period, nor did the French have that. And at that time, they're fighting guerrillas, they're fighting the Spanish armies. They keep coming back. They're down besieging Gibraltar, and so they're busy all through that time.
So what you're describing is kind of a three-way war, where we have three major players, the Anglo-Portuguese, the Spanish, and the French, and they all kind of have this dynamic where the English and Spanish are frenemies, maybe, and they're both fighting the French, but they're also not particularly cooperating?
Yeah, it's hilarious to read British cavalry journals when they first start entering Spain, because they're just disgusted. One, the Spanish eat garlic and they can't stand the smell. They say the women wear black and they spit tobacco juice in the corners. I mean, it's just, it's so over the top, xenophobic of what the British think of the Spanish. But at the same point, they have to work. You have a lot of stories about going out to nunneries and that and seeing nuns that just shocked the British. Yes, but the Spanish really, there's very few Spanish armies at that time that can work well. The Marquis de la Romana is one of the good ones that he's going to die. I believe it's 1810, that Wellington can get along with. And so he gets stuck in that dynamic. It really ends up being French and Spanish doing most of that fighting. And then it's going to be early 1812 when Napoleon pulls troops out. Initially, a lot of his Imperial Guard, a lot of the Dragoon divisions that are really effective against the counterinsurgency, they get pulled out for the Russian campaign. That changes the dynamic that allows Wellington very, very quickly to capture Badajoz, then race up and capture Ciudad Rodrigo, which gives him the two fortresses guarding the entryways into Portugal. He's going to make a quick run out into central Spain, goes to Salamanca, fights a battle there, will get into Madrid, only stays for a couple months. The French armies and the rest of Spain are going to come together, and Wellington will limp back to the Portuguese border by the fall of 1812. And then after the disaster of the Russian campaign, they're going to pull another, I think it's 150,000 out of Spain to reconstitute the Grand Armée, and that's going to permanently change the dynamic, which allows Wellington to come out and stay out, and he'll fight Victoria and then enter the Pyrenees and finally get down to Toulouse by the end of the war.
So, okay, as you said, one more thing I want to drill down on. We've talked about the land fighting, but Iberia, of course, is a peninsula. So what role do the maritime affairs play in all of this?
Well, if you look at the areas that the French are having success in counter-guerrilla operations, it's farther away from the coast. British shipping and supplies allows them to supply guerrillas. It allows them to do landing parties and capture little forts and bring supplies in. And so a lot of that is the retreat of guerrillas to those mountainous areas allows them to survive. And it's much of its supplies. Plus, we talked about the Spanish aren't able to feed themselves importing, so they're trying to import grain from France, and they're trying to use coastal lighters along the coast, and even that are being intercepted by British ships, particularly in the Mediterranean. So it has really a decisive flavor to the way the war is going to be. And then I mentioned about the 1813 campaign, which is really, you know, 1812 and the Salamanca campaign gives Wellington a national reputation. He's known in the UK at that point as their great hero. 1813 in the Victoria campaign really gives him an international. That's where he becomes known throughout Europe. And part of it is when he advances from Portugal, every other time he's advanced, he's always had this huge lines of communication leading back to Portugal, which is obviously a vulnerability that the French take advantage of. When he does the Victoria campaign, he uses the Royal Navy to take ports in the north coast, and he's actually advancing towards his lines of communication. So the French are trying to cut it, but there is no lines behind him.
Right.
He's advancing towards it. And again, that's part of that just brilliance of that campaign.
Yeah, it's a joint campaign, yeah.
So let's kind of start drilling down into what these armies look like. So we've been talking about the French army, the British army. But you highlighted a couple things of Dragoon divisions. So what do these armies kind of look like? Are they infantry heavy, cavalry heavy? I'm assuming not artillery heavy.
Yeah, no, not artillery heavy. And I'm not going to get into the Spanish army in particular because it's a whole subject in and of itself, and I'm not an expert on that. I mean, these are infantry heavy armies. If you look at like Marmont in 1812, I think there's 5 infantry divisions and 2 cavalry divisions. So I'd have to look at the exact numbers in there. So part of the problem is the sustainment of the cavalry horses. Just wagon trains and all that kind of stuff. We talked about how poor agriculturally the countryside is. Campaigns often are planned, like the 1812 and 1813 campaign, planned so the fields are ripening, so as they advance, they can turn their horses out to graze more, because the horses will deteriorate their conditions over campaign. They just can't get enough calories and for the wear and tear on them. Wellington's force in particular is going to be a mix of what they call second battalions. The Peninsula War is kind of the sideshow, if you will. Britain wants a more direct role in North Europe. Is going to have the Walcheren campaign, where all the first battalions, when you talk the regimental system, the first battalions are supposed to be the deployable battalion. The second battalions are supposed to be the depot that's providing either officers and men or horses that'll come out at periodic times, and then they bring in more recruits. So most of the first battalions go to the Walcheren campaign in the Netherlands. The second battalions ended up getting down into the peninsula, and Wellington will have them from good amount of time. He's also going to get some of the Walcheren troops, but they have, because of Walcheren fever, they are much, much sicker than the troops that have been in the peninsula who never went up there. Wellington's going to have mixed divisions as the Portuguese army, and it's one of the fights that he's going to have with the Regency in Portugal, is they want a independent Portuguese army. They are going to make the head of the Portuguese army a British officer, William Beresford, who's a great trainer, not so good on the battlefield. But the problem is with the pace of operations, Wellington's going to keep calling forward Portuguese units, particularly in 1810 campaign with Massena's invasion. They're going to bring so much in, and there's going to be everything from Portuguese divisions. There's going to be brigades of Portuguese troops, and there's also going to be British and Portuguese brigades, where you'll have one or two British battalions and a Portuguese battalion all mixed in there.
Okay, and I'm going to pull on something new, because we're using the term division, so mm-hmm. which in the modern U.S. Army we use quite frequently, but it's actually a fairly new term for that time frame. So does a British division look like a French division? And we all know the cavalry division's a smaller division mm-hmm. than infantry, because just number of people. But what does a British division look like by, say, a French division? Well, and I'll also pass that over to Abel, too.
Well, I was going to say, a British division is going to look much like a French division, when you have brigades with regiments, but they're really battalions underneath there. The staffs, however, are more personal staffs, so it goes with the officer. So if you're a regimental or a brigade commander, you'll have your aide-de-camps and your officers. And many times, if you get moved up to the next level, you'll take everyone with you, and the next officer down will take it. So you don't have that commonality. That's one of the things that Wellington will do, is he's going to build this staff for the army, and the army in the peninsula operates under his personal, I guess, not whims, that's too negative a term, but it's based on his idiosyncrasies and the way he likes to operate. And so he builds and gets the right people that he can. There's always a fight with horse guards, their headquarters, of who he's going to get in the peninsula, but he builds kind of a personal structure there, but relatively built like a French division would be. You know, it's going to have brigades are going to be artillery in those brigades. They'll be artillery at the army level. The cavalry divisions will have cavalry regiments with horse artillery, usually a battery with each brigade. they don't, and part of this goes into, when you look at the cavalry, the issue of he doesn't have absolute say of who he's going to get. And Wellington, Arthur Wellesley, when he comes out, is a relatively junior officer in the British Army. So he gets local rank in the peninsula. It's one of the reasons why he never goes home. He does not, like many British officers, go home to England for the winter and then come back in there. He doesn't go home. And part of the issue is if he leaves, there's a chance he may be superseded. So he stays.
Which, if I remember correctly, he had that issue very early on, right? Where he's kind of, he's there and some senior officers come and he's kind of pushed back.
Yeah, when he is not meant to be the commander on the ground.
Right, because he's just this guy from India. Yeah, he's not really anybody.
He's a major general. He's relatively junior. Barat and Dalrymple are the two senior commanders of the expedition. He lands, is going to fight Ruth and then go down to Viermo, and he's setting up his defense when the next senior guy comes. And senior guy does not, knows there's going to be a fight, does not want to supersede Wellington or Wellesley at the time, because if you lose, because the thing, it would come back on you. So he stays on board the ship. Wellesley will fight the battle, and then the senior commanders brought, and then Dalrymple will come ashore and take command. And that's where the convention of Cintra comes, where they are going to allow the French to be evacuated on British ships back to France with all their stuff, and that will get all three of them recalled. Mm-hmm. But Wellesley was not in favor of it, and he will survive that. Mm-hmm. And once John Moore comes, he's going to lead the British forces after that initial campaign, after the Cintra gets beaten, they evacuate, and then there's going to be a rump of forces left in Portugal, and they need to send someone back, and that's where Wellesley will go back. Mm-hmm. Plus, he's the connections with his brothers in the government allows him to have a lot of say. But he's relatively junior. Mm-hmm. He'll get a local lieutenant general position. Is what they do. They give you promotion based on the time. So.
So for the structure, we're looking at divisions are pretty French division.
Go back to that division thing.
Well, no, I just want to kind of a French division looks much like a British division, which is you're going to have regiments brigaded together.
Mm-hmm.
They're going to have some artillery organic to that organization.
So the way I describe it is a Napoleonic division is combined arms, but not necessarily all arms, right? And that's the whole point of the corps, is that the corps is all arms. But remember, that's a French thing, and you don't necessarily see that same degree of sophistication. Yeah,
you're not going to see cavalry in the British divisions. The British cavalry will be under the two cavalry divisions that are going to be there and held in that type.
So basically what you're describing then is, in the British Army, we have infantry artillery divisions and cavalry artillery divisions.
Correct.
Combined arms, but not all arms.
Right.
And another distinction that you noted is that the French division seemed to have a little bit more of a professional staff, whereas the British division started out with that.
Remember, the British Army is venal, meaning positions are sold, I think, until the 1850s, 1860s.
Yeah,
well after the other military is professional.
But it's a very small portion of it. I don't have the numbers in my head anymore, but the positions are sold because that's your retirement, right? So it's not necessarily a bad thing. And they have put in a series of reforms that means you can't just, if you're a rich colonel, you know, rich aristocrat, you can't buy your son a colonelcy, right? He has to hold all the ranks at the various ranks going up for a certain amount of time in there. But it's meant to be that that's the retirement. But when you have officer casualties, you don't have to do it. And so the use of the purchase system goes way down during the actual Peninsula War because there's open positions based on deaths.
Would it be fair to say that the British Army is seeing a growing professionalization? Or are we kind of squishy with that term?
We are squishy with that term because I would make the argument. I did a talk at the Dole Institute of Politics many years ago about three different armies at Waterloo, and there's a modern French army, there's a kind of in-between hybrid Prussian army, and then there's an ancien regime British army there. because of all the armies, it is probably the most backwards of it. I'm sure British listeners right now are grimacing, but it's so much of the Ancien Régime type of stuff that goes in there. And, you know, and when you talk about that, so, for example, coming out of the American War of Independence in the 1780s, 1790s, looking to get, as the Revolutionary War starts, the British Army has to have reform. They don't have a single drill manual. There's different speeds that the infantry marches and all that stuff. And so Dundas is going to write a series of manuals based on the Prussian model. He gets the nickname Old Pivot because his manuals are so focused on the drill portion of it and turning and stopping and realigning and
how
then
many
turning.
Inches you lift your feet.
Exactly. And he does the same thing with the cavalry manuals, which don't work out all that well. And it's interesting if you look at the French cavalry doctrine from like the year 10, so 83, and then you look at the British doctrine and thing, there's an entire difference. The British say, do this, do this, do this, and they never explain why. And the French manual actually, it's a series of questions and answers. Why would you do this? You know, and you would do this because, da, 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 and then tells you what the actual piece is. And so there's a real backward portion of it. And going specifically on the cavalry, the British Army is so small. It's about 80,000 soldiers at the start of the war, so it'll expand. But they don't have the specialization. Owen Conley talks about, you know, French cavalry, and especially the heavy cavalry. It's big men on big horses who charge. They've got a spear, hatch point sword that's not meant for hacking, but for pointed. The British say that, however, because they don't have that many heavy units, they don't have that many medium, they don't have any light, everyone charges. And it's kind of interesting to look at. So, for example, the Dragoon regiments in the British cavalry, the light, or not the light dragoons, because those are really just hussars and light cavalry, but the medium regiments, compared to the French, outside of Coimbra during the 1810 invasion by Massena, there's a British dragoon regiment who's fighting, and a French dragoon regiment comes into the town, dismounts, grabs their muskets, and starts running through the buildings and starts fighting his infantry. And the British are just absolutely stunned. There's a journal of an officer who talks about, you know, the French got off their horses, and it was like a swarm of ants. I can't believe they did that. That's why you're wearing infantry boots. That's why you're carrying a musket. Yep. You're supposed to be able to do that. But their doctrine, the only thing in the cavalry manual about dragoons, tells them how to dismount, form a battalion to march by in review. Talks about nothing about fighting on the ground.
So let's take a couple minutes to just kind of detail out the different parts of the Napoleonic era cavalry. Mm-hmm. So you mentioned hussars, mm-hmm. dragoons, and then some heavy, which I'm going to let Dr. Abel say the
cuirassier.
There you go. Or the British version of it. So what kind of types are out there? What do they do?
All right. So for the British in particular, they're going to have what's known as light dragoons. And even the hussar regiments at the time normally will say, you know, it'll be the 15th light dragoons, parentheses, hussar. And the only difference is the uniforms, right? But they have the same missions. And they're supposed to be relatively small, lighter equipment, smaller horses that don't take as much food, are more agile to be able to do the reconnaissance mission. The medium cavalry, which is the dragoons, and they have the dragoon guards, and they have the dragoons, are meant to be basically like the U.S. dragoons are supposed to be. You get off the horse, you can fight as infantry. They usually wear infantry-type boots. They're going to have longer, long arms. They're going to have muskets versus carbines. And they're supposed to be able to dismount and fight. However, in the British service, I don't think I have a single example of British dragoons dismounting and fighting as dragoons during the entire Peninsula War.
And as you point out, I'll jump in real quick, the French have done this for a century. French mm-hmm. dragoons date back to the 17th century. They wear infantry boots, they don't wear spurs, mm-hmm. they carry muskets, and they are trained as infantry in not just drill, but fighting. Mm-hmm. going all the way back to the 1680s. So this is a very different tradition from the French Dragoon tradition.
Yeah, except, of course, they're using the term. And they've got some of the trappings, but it's just fascinating. They don't differentiate in there. And then they've got their heavy regiments, mm-hmm. Which is Life Guards and the Royal Horse Guards, who actually wear crosses. They don't deploy with them when they finally come into the peninsula, but they're supposed to be the heavy cavalry with the straight swords, not sabers, who are designed to charge big men on big horses. There's a light dragoon who writes in late 1812 when they finally get the horse guards. 1813, when some of the horse guards get there, and this big guy, this magnificent horse, and his comment is, you know, the ration's not going to go very far in a guy that big, because they're always not well fed. But they're meant to be only used for the charge. But Wellington has such a dearth of cavalry throughout most of his campaigns that he uses them all interchangeably. Now, the heaviest of those units don't come until after the successes of the 1812 campaign, and he makes the case that we need them for the invasion of Spain in 1813, and that's when they'll start to deploy. He also has some really interesting troops, which are the King's German Legion, which are Hanoverians who have fled Hanover after Napoleon has gone in the 1805 campaign, gone to England, and basically formed a King's German Legion. So you have cavalry, you have infantry, you have artillery with there, and they were going to come. Different uniforms, command language is German in the regiments, German Hanoverian officers, and they're going to have heavy cavalry and light cavalry in there, as well as infantry, and they are very, very good. There's a lot of problems, and part of it is just the way the British in the early part look at being an officer. You know, you do. There was an example of one of the German officers who come in, speaks English. He goes into the British service and he gets to his regiment and wants to learn how to do all these things. He says, "You just learn the commands. The soldiers know how to execute them." And so his NCOs get him away from it. And I can't remember which of the dragoon. I think it's one of the dragoon guards gets into Portugal in 1809 or 1810. And they're getting their rations, and their horses continue to deteriorate in its their just physical ability. And finally, one of the quartermasters goes out and follows the food, the fodder, from issuing down to feeding. And what he finds out is that the soldiers are selling it to the Portuguese in exchange for alcohol and getting drunk, and the horses are just grazing out on the farms or on the fields, and they can't get enough calories to do it. So their conditions keep doing it because no officers there to actually watch them. And it almost seems ludicrous, if you will. You have light cavalry who is supposed to do the reconnaissance of the army. However, up until 1810, they don't have a manual that tells them how to do it, and it's going to be a German Arnstead who's going to take and write a manual for outpost duty that tells just a lot of it's what we would consider techniques, TTPs, techniques,
tactics
and procedures. You know, things like take your big hat off when you get ready to crest a hill so the enemy doesn't see your hat. How to, you know, if you see infantry, you spin your horse around to the left, but if you see cavalry, you spin it around to the right so you can communicate. And those type of techniques, just how to establish a picket line and have, you know, the actual pickets out, then you have a reserve out, and then main. He writes all that, and that's what's going to be used in the army, and it's going to increase the effectiveness of the British cavalry throughout the war.
Worth noting, this is important because these troops are from Germany, and all throughout the 18th century and into the Napoleonic period, the Germans are reckoned to be the horse masters. Austria and Prussia have the cavalry, the French kind of copy it, and Napoleonic cavalry is very good, but it's still that German idea. That's where the stud farms are. Mm-hmm. So that's an important connection there.
So the other, so we've looked at the British. Mm-hmm. How does that contrast to, say, the French cavalry? Kind of their opponents.
Yeah, unfortunately, I mean, the French cavalry, their doctrine is very good. Much more, and particularly why dragoon, I think at one point there's five dragoon divisions in Spain. because they can get down off their horses and chase guerrillas up rocky places. I mean, it's they are the perfect ones to do the counterinsurgency type of thing. The problem they have is they don't have the logistics system that's going to allow them to feed their horses effectively. So French horses tend to be not as good as British horses for the most part.
When they're not selling their fodder for alcohol.
Yeah, when they're not selling their fodder. But, I mean, when you see... You'll see time and time again where British cavalry will do things that just absolutely astound. There's a couple of times where British cavalry will jump a stone wall, and the French cavalry is just amazed because they can't do that. Their horses just don't have the physical stamina to be able to do it. And then, of course, there's the Portuguese cavalry, which is by far has the worst horses because the French come in 1808 and steal all the horses and take them back with them. Then the British come in with more money and they purchase what's left of the good horses, and then what's ever left that hadn't been stolen or bought because they're in bad shape, that's what gets bought for the Portuguese cavalry. So they tend to be, unfortunately, the worst arm for their mounts.
So the French are generally better trained, have better doctrine, but are less capable of executing it.
Right.
Whereas the British have emerging doctrine, working on their training, but have better capability.
Yeah,
is that a
good way to I would say that's a good thing. You know, and it's interesting because by the middle part of the war, if you want to go say 1810 to 1813 or so, the British cavalry has become very, very good. They're getting rid of the not very good officers, the William Erskines, the Jack Slades, who had gotten their positions because of some sort of patronage. Erskine, as a captain in the Low Countries, had led a cavalry charge to save the Austrian emperor at a battle. And so he is going to be able to rise up. And you know, despite the fact he's partly deaf and partly blind, he can't see far out. Slade's got a connection with the Prince of Wales, gets the ship to sail, and Slade has forgotten his saber, and the Prince of Wales takes his off and gives it to him. So, I mean, there's these connections that Wellington can't get rid of despite how ineffective they may be because of their seniority. And it's only if they go home because they're sick or something he's able to put good people into his thing. But by 1812 or so, he's been able to replace most of them. He finally, in the summer of 1812, rises up with enough political wherewithal that he can ask for officers to be sent home and ask for different replacements, and he actually creates the army that he wants. But by that time, the cavalry, I would make the argument, is doing very, very well. It has taken those early 1810 light cavalry duties and has practice and has been able to function effectively.
So you bring up something very interesting. Wellington is sometimes seen and often portrayed on screen, in particular, as this kind of martinet who's very upper class and does not care what happens beneath him.
Mm-hmm.
What you're describing is somebody who's very interested in the details of training and his force management, as we would call it. So how is he managing the force to create an effective army in Iberia?
Yeah, you know, it's fascinating to see that portrayal. I think back to that really terrible movie with John Malkovich, Lines of Tours Vader or something with him, and it's just filled. He's this kind of aloof, effeminate type of guy who does an amazing amount of work in work ethic, where, you know, 40 to 60 handwritten papers a day, where he's sitting there in every sort of detail of the army. And part of it, he has to fight the horse guards, he has to fight the bureaucracy, because there's different portions of the British establishment's control of different parts of the army. He's having to work through that, finding the right person for the right job, getting it. But the details for military punishment, military discipline, courts martials and that type of stuff, to the actual performance on the battlefield, he's very much in tune with. And he may be a bit aloof for the things, but for junior officers who are from well-bred families, he has them to his table and, you know, is very lively. I think he has a pack of 40 dogs for, you know, when he gets a chance, particularly when they're sitting in Portugal to do the box hunt. In there, but the details of what he does, and when you look at Wellington's dispatches, either the dispatches, the supplementary dispatches, I mean, they're just absolutely incredible, the amount of detail on a day-to-day basis of the supplies. Plus, Admiral Barclay, the British Royal Navy commander there, that he fosters a very, very good a good relationship with, that Barclay actually will disobey the Admiralty at times to support Wellington, particularly during the 1810 campaign, is fascinating, because he's working those relationships and understanding that, okay, London's far away and I can get a certain amount of coverage that'll allow me to be successful.
Okay, so let's drill down a little bit on the detail of the cavalry functioning. Let's say Wellington is on one of his campaigns. He's crossing from Portugal into Spain. He's on campaign, so there's no battle yet. What is his cavalry doing?
Well, the cavalry's doing what cavalry always does, reconnaissance and security. So they are preventing the enemy from surprising your columns in march, interfering with your lines of communications, and they're trying to figure out where the enemy is. And so they're operating semi-autonomously out to the front in flanks of it. Depending on the campaign, for example, during the 1810 campaign, that's going to push the army all the way back to the lines of Torres Vedras above Lisbon, and then the advance back up. The cavalry commander, Stapleton Cotton, who's a lieutenant general in local rank, is going to outrank Brigadier General Crawford, who's commanding the light division. And so what you actually have covering force is a cavalry infantry covering force under the command of the cavalry commander, which is almost never how it's portrayed in books. It's always, he talks about the light division doing this. Well, the light division works for the cavalry division commander, and is integrating that in there to be able to do the covering force mission and provide security for the army in there. And, you know, if you think about 6 years of the Peninsula War, so you're talking, what, 1,800 days, roughly. 40 of those days are days of battle, and that's where cavalry has to charge. The other 1,760 days, the cavalry's out in the front every single one of those days. Even if the infantry is back in quarters, in cantonments for the winter, there's a cavalry screen out in front, screening the lines, making sure the French aren't, you know, collecting rations from this little village or trying to surprise an outpost or anything like that. And that they do very, very effectively. By 1810, they've gotten the practice down, and then they have the doctrine, and they're going to pretty darn good. And you look at them as a covering force, say, for example, the Salamanca campaign. We tend to focus on the Battle of Salamanca, but it's really about a 2 months of maneuver and counter-maneuver with Marmont up and down that central corridor, where both armies about the same size are looking for an advantage to attack. And the famous story, at least the Battle of Salamanca, Marmont, supposedly his divisions get separated. Wellington's eating a chicken and sees that there's been a mistake, throws the chicken leg over his shoulder and says, "I got him," and orders an attack. That type of thing is not normally how Wellington is portrayed. You know, he's portrayed as a defensive commander and and looking, yeah, exactly. But really, it's most of his campaigns are, especially between 1811 and 1813, are offensive campaigns, maneuver type campaigns. And a key element of that is knowing where the enemy is, what the enemy's doing, and preventing the enemy from interfering with you. And that's what the cavalry's doing on a day-to-day basis.
And there's a really good book on Wellington's early career in India by Hugh Davies, who goes into this. He goes at the idea of Wellington as a defensive commander and says, no, for most of his career, he's actually an offensive commander.
And in that piece of what he learns from his earlier career, because Hugh makes the point of Wellington's worrying about logistics so much, and his concern, his planning comes from India, and he takes that experience into Portugal and Spain, and because of the lack of or the destruction of the infrastructure from the fighting, that it allows him to be successful, to keep his army fed. Because he has a couple of experiences, you know, not his personal experience, but the retreat to Coruña, which is, again, covered by the cavalry, but the infantry is going to break down because they don't have rations, and they're going to break into some of the stories about them breaking into towns and the big vats of wine, or they'll fire their musket through the wooden vat, so a hole, you know, 75 caliber hole comes out, and then they lay there drinking as it spurts out like a fountain.
Soldiers never change.
Well, and some drowned in the gutter of wine. And so that breaking apart of discipline is one of the big concerns Wellington has. And it only happens even closest during the retreat from Burgos in 1812, where they start to lose their rations, send their logistics one route and the army a different route as they retreat back. And that, for the most part, is what he works to prevent through there.
So when the when you've got the cavalry out there maneuvering, they're guarding these lines of communication. They're finding the opponent. What does a fight? So we talk about the cavalry charge, the stirrup to stirrup guys going at it. But that's, as you pointed, that's not that's not the reality. So what does a cavalry fight look like for these guys?
A skirmish.
That's a good word.
Yeah. It all depends. There's some of it is going to be, you know, sniping at each other with carbines from a distance. You know, typically you just kind of sit and look at each other until one person has this moral ascendancy and starts to push. But say, for example, the retreat back towards Salamanca that's going to lead to the Battle of Salamanca, you see a number of rear guard actions where the British cavalry will hold up, force the French to deploy infantry, and then really to deploy infantry and artillery. As soon as they start to do that and get effective, then the British cavalry will pull back and reestablish another position. And then the French have to reestablish their movement. They start moving forward again. And you get the enemy to continue to deploy into a force. So you don't necessarily see a lot of cavalry charges back and forth. What you're going to see is artillery come up, start to unlimber, maybe an artillery duel between the horse artilleries of the two until the infantry comes up and more artillery that's going to be able to drive them off. And then they break contact, retreat back to the next terrain feature and do it again. And so it's more of a delaying action. There are some cavalry charges, relatively few for the most part. You see a lot of them down during the siege of Badajoz in 1811-1812 time period down because there's a plane that heads south from Badajoz, still gets to the mountains just outside of Seville. And there in that area, it's just big open plain. You see a lot of these cavalry type fights that are pure cavalry brigade versus cavalry brigade.
So what I'm hearing is that, like, so the Peninsular War is probably the most maneuver intensive period for the British Army, really, since the American Revolution, if not more.
Oh yeah,
and I'd say more so because it's much bigger formation.
Yes,
So what you're saying is that the cavalry is basically enabling all this maneuver to happen.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and the other thing too, we often get the charge wrong when it does happen. For one, you don't charge prepared formations. Movies get this wrong all the time, with the exception of Waterloo, which shows what happens when horse do charge prepared formations and the British squares destroy the French horse that do. So you want to use cavalry when your infantry and artillery, your fires, have softened the enemy. It's your shock force that comes second. And it's in some ways it's opposite of the way we think of things now, where you want the maneuver to be supported by the fires. The other thing we get wrong is we often show the charge as being just a bunch of dudes on horses moving in the same direction. The charge is actually relatively slow. If you look at cavalry manuals, at least the French ones, you can speak to the British ones, you start very, very slow in a formation because if you gallop, you lose your formation. And if you lose your formation, there's no point.
It's not just losing the formation, it's you blow the horses.
Yeah.
And once they're blown for the day. And so British manuals exactly that, where you start off at a walk. And at a certain distance, you go to the trot. And at a certain distance, relatively slow, you go to the gallop.
And it's close. This is not right. Like you're not you know a mile away from the enemy. You're like 50 yards from the enemy when you
or
gallop.
Less.
Yeah.
The only time I know of a successful cavalry charge against an infantry square in the Peninsula Wars, Garcia Hernandez, where the King's German Legion. It's the day after the Battle of Salamanca. The French rear guards. The King's German Legion comes up. They have formed two squares on a hill. Three squares. It might be three squares. But anyway, they charge. A horse gets shot just a couple steps outside the square. It starts to tumble, falls on the men in the front square. And then everyone comes into the inside and charges the inside. Those guys then run to the second square, and them running to the second square opens up the hole that square gets done. And it's finally, I think, this third square that stands mm-hmm. does it. But it's so infrequently. Mm-hmm. And that's, I think, one of the good things that the movie Waterloo does is it shows that cavalry just kind of
yep.
going around because there's nothing they can do. The charge, you know, they part like water around it and they come around. And then they'll come racing at it again and part like water, but there's nothing they can do.
And so this is a feature of cavalry throughout history. This happens at Pharsalus. It happens at Rocroi. Horses are not tanks. They have minds. Mm-hmm. They don't like to charge the men with sharp pointy things unless the men with sharp pointy things are running away.
Well, yeah. Like American cavalry doctrine, early 20th century, like basically they like if the infantry's prepared, don't. They right. they're a little bit more erudite right. than that, but not much.
And I've heard, I don't know which is true. One is that horses don't like to step on people, so that's one of the reasons why they do. The other one is that the bayonets on the muskets look like a wall, mm-hmm. and they won't charge into a wall. Mm-hmm. Do not know. I cannot think. What a cavalry horse think, but you know, either one of those could be possibly true of why they will not. You just can't make them go and do that.
Right. Well, so I want to kind of wrap this up by asking both of you, both veterans, Dr. Gerges, armor officer, Dr. Nance, cavalry officer. So this is a very different kind of war. It's fought over 200 years ago. Obviously, we use horses much anymore. So what are the comparisons between, you know, particularly British Napoleonic Peninsula War cavalry and the way cavalry works now?
Don't use cavalries and horses. Talk about the missions they do. It's security, it's reconnaissance, it's all those things that are enabling maneuvering commanders to make decisions. And that's exactly what they do then, and it's what we do today. The other thing I think is interesting is looking at the effectiveness of units when you start to drill down. My dissertation in particular was on the effectiveness of the British cavalry, looking at organizations, looking at leadership, and looking at doctrine and how those go together to build effective organizations and how they're changed in wartime, which is still, regardless of the time, a active thing that you can be doing, evaluating what's the doctrine, who and what your leadership you're building, what your capabilities to build the most effective force for the threat you're trying to face.
Yeah, cavalry enables maneuver. It hasn't really changed, as Dr. just mentioned. And what I find interesting is that in the Napoleonic Wars, we tend to think of these armies maneuvering on the ground, almost like ships at sea, right? Where, I'm maneuvering. But there's a lot more bits and pieces that you forget about because, as we've talked about a couple times, logistics kind of matters. Guys like to eat. Horses like to eat. Horses go downhill really fast, and then the problem is when a horse goes down, a cavalryman might not have the boots meant for riding are not the boots meant for walking.
Unless you're a dragoon.
Unless you're a dragoon, and as a dragoon, you're even then not walking around a lot.
Right.
So all of these bits and pieces are already in place in the Peninsula War. If you kind of drill into the specifics, what you see is not a naval war on land, so to speak, but truly a swirling war of maneuver where all the arms are playing their parts.
One of my future projects I always wanted to do is take Wellington's dispatches, looking at his logistics-specific pieces during a particular campaign, because maps tend to show where units' headquarters are, and there's a little square, and there's that, and then there's headquarters way, you know, miles to the rear. And yet what you have is this kind of entire circulatory system that's feeding those forward units. And then, of course, all those units are taking up a space. And Wellington's dispatches talks about, you know, this regiment has these couple of towns that they are going to cantone in and then also forage around when they turn their horses out. And filling in the map of Portugal with just a, here's what a typical day, mm-hmm. you know, of Wellington, the Anglo-Portuguese army, and the logistics, how much stuff is being moved forward, you mm-hmm. know, how much, when you talk 600 wagons with no bearings, so they're squeaky, the axles, how much stuff are they moving? Mm-hmm. You know, is that like a train load or something? But just kind of seeing that piece, to go back to Bill's point, it's not just a line on the map in this big sea. Mm-hmm. There's a huge piece to keep it fed and moving forward.
Yeah, and I think we've made a good point for researchers and grad students that what's called the petite guerre, the war away from the big battles and the blocks on the map, is criminally understudied in mm-hmm. these campaigns, in all armies. Mm-hmm. So this has been a fascinating discussion. Dr. Curtis, thank you.
Yeah, you're welcome.
If you like this episode, please make sure to check out our other podcast, Broad Gauge Gossips, where we talk to members of the Department of Military History faculty so you can get to know them.